Hello and welcome to a new English edition of my podcast Helium Talk, das Kunstgespräch. My name is Jörg Heikhaus and my guest today is Laurence Vallière. Yes, well, it has been 2 weeks since my last podcast and a lot has happened. On Saturday, we've opened a new show at Helium Cowboy with the name Lass mal Kornern. That was conceived, curated and executed by Melvin, the manager of the gallery, and our assistant Johanna. It's a group show with over 20 artists that takes place in a tiny fictional art kiosk inside the gallery. My only job here was building that kiosk. So I got a ton of plywood and reduced our space from its 150 to roughly 20 square meter, basically closing off the main part of the gallery and only using the entrance area. Lots of work, but also really good fun. I like building things like that, and the show Melvin put together is very strong and fits perfectly into that cozy space. It was wonderful to see how well received the show was on opening night. I'm very happy that the work of Melvin and Johanna and of course all the artists involved was so greatly appreciated. 21 artist names are too much to read out loud in this intro, so please check it out on my Instagram at Helium Cowboy or get in touch if you want to take a look when you are in town. Other than that, I hope you did not mind too much the longer break between my podcasts. It really gives me a lot more breathing space, and I already invited a number of great people for future recordings, so stay tuned for some good talks coming up on this channel. Well, do you actually say that? Channel? This channel? Well, it doesn't matter. You know what I mean. But now to my guest. Laurence Vallière is a Canadian sculptor from Quebec. She works with recycled cardboard and builds incredibly realistic animals that often are larger than life. She has been showing internationally at galleries, institutions and many urban art festivals. She even created two of her oversized gorillas for Burning Man 2016. She has only been around a few years in the art world, but has already made a big name for herself because of the uniqueness of her work.
Helium Talk.
I first met Laurence a few years ago when I did an interview with her for the German newspaper Die Zeit. She was part of the Knotenpunkt Festival in Hamburg in 2014 and has returned twice since. When she came to grace this year's Knotenpunkt at the Affenfaust Gallery again, it was the perfect opportunity to invite her to the studio and record a show with her. Alright, as always, let me know what you think in the comments, as a message on Instagram, or by sending a mail to hello@heliumtalk.com, and don't forget the ratings and reviews on iTunes, for example. I always appreciate your feedback and being faithful to my podcast, so please keep listening. But for now, have a great day you all, and I hope you enjoy this 58th episode of the Helium Talk podcast with Laurence Vallière. Laurence, this time around, did you visit the zoo again?
No, that's, I forgot I visited the zoo already. No, yeah. I did nothing. I saw the same apartment, the same gallery, the same road between the apartment and the gallery.
Yeah.
That's about that.
So that was like 2014 and 2015 you were here, 14 the first time. And I just remembered with the zoo because I looked up the article that we made for that newspaper in 2014 and saw the video of the Knotenpunkt Festival then of your, and you were in the zoo.
That is right. I remember. That's not even the, I guess that was the first time I was taken to a zoo to do a promotion of a show. And then That kept happening. I went to many zoos.
All right. Do you like zoos?
Well, I did not until I worked in a zoo in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And then I realized that I was taught that zoos are nowadays are a lot more like conservatory gardens. I don't know really how to call them, but more than zoos. You can't really, they're very, very careful which animals they have, if they have enough room to stimulate the animals and to also work on preservation. So every zoo in America, probably the same in Europe, has a species that they're working on to keep from disappearing. So zoos are a lot more interesting than just, you know, animal prisons.
Yeah, I basically just saw the development of zoos because I have children, you know. I would probably not go to zoos otherwise if it wouldn't be with the kids. Children, you know?
Yeah, zoos are
And fun. I think these are things that you, I mean, it's beautiful to do those things, but I think if you don't have kids or not a profession like yours, it's probably a lot of people don't even go to zoos anymore. And know what they are. I mean, when I was a kid, when I went to the zoo in Cologne, definitely wasn't like a preservation like that.
No, they've changed. They've changed. Because, they're disgusting. I remember zoos when I was young. They smell. They had tiny cages. Mm-hmm. And I remember gorillas being very overweight. And apparently there was some domestic violence among the gorillas. Mm-hmm. That's not good. Like that means there's issues with the zoo.
Yeah, totally. So first, I wanted to also give a shout out to Bash from Urban Skills for bringing us together.
Yes, thank you, Bash.
And then to Affenfaust for bringing you back to Hamburg again.
Yes.
You're part of the Knotenpunkt Festival, which is this urban art festival that they've started in 2000.
Was it 2014?
I don't know.
Or 2013?
I think it was the year before you were there.
Yeah.
I think it was the second time when you were there.
Okay.
I was part of that at once too.
Yes, you were.
Yeah. And now it goes, I don't know, and, you know, sort of into the next edition here in Hamburg. That's one thing when I've been looking. I mean, you're on a lot of these urban art festivals, but you don't actually have a background in any urban art. You just grew into that, right?
Yes. No, I did not start as an urban artist, but I stumbled into the world of urban art, and it works well enough.
And now your sculptures are also part of, I mean, of public spaces, right?
What do you mean?
Yeah, I mean, they're just, sort of you create sculptures that are now part of the public space. So in that way, truly urban art, because they're in an urban environment. That's what I mean.
Yes, for sure. But I have a hard time letting them outside. Yeah. So I've made one in Coroplast, in recycled plastic. And that one can stay outdoor.
It's the one you just turned pink?
Yes, that's the rabbit I just turned pink.
It's in Toronto?
It's in Toronto, yeah.
Okay. So because that just means you would be working completely different, right? When you work with the plastic or?
No, it's the same. It looks good, like the same enough. But it's more difficult. It's heavier. It's longer. Mm-hmm. And I work with rivets and nails and screws. It's not the same thing.
It's not the same thing.
But it looks the same. That's the point.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, first time we met, you did a polar bear, a very big one.
Yes.
That was also like this ecological point to make, or that you're making. You're probably, in that term, you're always mostly referring, or your reference is mostly animals. In your sculptures, that has that changed over the years?
No, it's still the same. I'm not done with the subject.
Yeah.
I've started to make also cartoons since.
Yeah.
And I work a lot with brands that I find, because I find my cardboard everywhere, right? So I'm inspired by cereal breads and whatever color that I find. So I've used cartoons to show consumerism, I guess. But it's all the same. It's all the same meaning.
All the same meaning.
Yeah, like symbol, consumerism, abuse of object, like using, overusing, and ecology, I guess.
Do you think that's one of the reasons why people like to invite you? I mean, except from that you're a fantastic person and a great artist.
Yeah, I don't think it's personal.
No, but I mean, is that something that is? I mean, I think it's sometimes lacking in a lot of public art. There is some kind of political conscience or in there. I mean, there's also a lot where it's not, but I mean, this is something that.
Yeah, but I think festivals, urban art festivals especially, like they like the alternative that I offer sculptures, but I can make them on site and quickly, just like a street artist.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have like a variation, not just paintings and murals, but also sculptures. And on top of that, it has a nice message/meaning. And cardboard is free.
Yeah. Well, so, it's sometimes hard to get by. I guess like in Germany, I think it's not that easy. Or
To
get the cardboard?
No, it's easy.
Yeah.
Just walking by to your gallery, I found some nice cardboard.
Okay, because I think the last time you had somebody organizing it for you, and in this interview, this German guy who helped you says it's different in Germany because usually all the cardboard that we have here, except for the one we keep for packaging and stuff like that, we throw in the bin immediately, you know, so...
Oh, yeah, but it's because I was being particular with him and he was trying to... I like IKEA cardboard because it's thin and I can bend it the way I want. And so we went to IKEA and I realized that in Germany, and probably the same in Canada, but I never knew that, they sell the cardboard to recycling companies.
Okay.
So they buy the bundles of cardboard, so they didn't want to give it to us. So that's why he was like, oh, it's complicated. Well, it's complicated because we went directly. We thought I could take it at the source.
I've loved to work with, I still love to work with old and seasoned wood, and it doesn't necessarily have to be very nice or beautiful. It just has to be old and has scars and shows some age. And it has gotten more and more difficult to find that wood. Now I'm buying it mostly because there's a big business around old wood. Everything you see here has bought the wood. You know, it's not that I took a shed apart. but I could do that, you know, years ago. I could go into the countryside and just go to a farmhouse and say, what about your old wood? Can I have that? And they said, sure, why not? You know, sometimes I gave them money for it, or sometimes they were just happy taking it.
Yeah, but old cardboard has discarded pizza on it. It's not the same.
Yeah, that's true. So, but this, you said something. You said something interesting about the brands. There was something there that I was curious about. I've seen that in your work. Then you basically, I don't know what was it. I think it was soft Mountain Dew or something, like a soft drink, something that's extremely sugary and very bad for your health. And you just used that, and you did, like, I think was it Yoshi or so from Mario Kart. Yeah.
The Yoshi from the Mario Bros.
World. Thanks, yeah.
Well, because he's green and Mountain Dew is green as well. And I also thought, you know, I don't know if I'm right, but Mountain Dew would be more geared toward children, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so we offer them a really, really sugary drink. And so they ask for it to their parents, you know. And we use those joyful, happy characters like Yoshi. Like, not saying that Mountain Dew, that's not fair to say that Mountain Dew uses Yoshi to sell. But I'm just blending... urban culture, I guess, together.
Well, you're doing two brand violations at the same time.
Exactly. I'm just annoying too.
Yeah, but are they annoyed though? I mean, it's probably not gonna hurt either of these large companies. Do they ever come and say, do this for us for promotional reasons?
No, never. Don't like my work. I don't know. No, and I don't know what I would say. But no, never. I never had like a company asking me. Sometimes they want, like, if I have sponsors, they would like me to use their boxes to put, you know, like their brands, which I don't mind depending on the company.
Yeah.
That's the way public art is financed nowadays. So.
Well, there's got to be a way to make money. I'm not sure whether gallery shows and everything will be able to maintain all these artists that are around right now. I mean, I also think it's probably difficult with...
I think it's both. I have no problem selling. Like, I could live off of that, but sometimes it's nice to... The giant projects, like, people can't really place like a 2-meter tall sculptures in their backyard. Although, you'd be surprised, because I have done that for families and some private collectors. But it's... Sometimes in some project that are really exciting, like, for example, the rabbit again, the pink rabbit in Toronto. Well, that was sponsored by a company.
Mm-hmm. But it's a public work now, right?
It's given to the city of Toronto and an organization over there that I don't know exactly what they do, Stacked. But it's a really cool space.
So you think, like, and in 2014, it was more difficult to sell your big bear, even though everybody liked it and everybody took photos with it, and your smaller sculptures on the walls, they were gone pretty quickly.
Yes.
And then I think it took the Milanto auction to gallery auction to sell the bear.
Yeah, they managed, though. Yeah. They managed to sell it. That's awesome.
Yeah. And all the buyer. I had to teach her though how you're called and who you are, who the artist is, because you, there's nobody really. That's a thing sometimes. It's pretty sad sometimes with art when it comes to auctions and all these things, especially these events, these large big events, like the Millantor Gallery has become a very large event. And the woman that bought that piece for her family, she didn't even know who the artist was. Oh, she was not interested. And I told her because she was posting and I said, okay, you should probably just mention who made this, you know?
Oh, that's fine. That happens all the time.
But that's happening, of course.
Listen, at Burning Man, I had Diplo taking pictures in front of my gorilla, and I think there was like, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of like. He didn't even post my name. He didn't know who I was. You know what?
Who was that?
See, I don't even know who he is. Not Diplo. I think he's a DJ.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't know either.
Oh, he's going.
Yeah, well, there are people
that we never met.
Well, there are people that are pretty influential in the internet. But yeah, I think even though if he would have mentioned you and he has 500,000 likes, probably of these 500,000 people, nobody would have been interested anyway. It's like the people we touch are.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter. Yeah, like, the guy still posted my sculptures.
Yeah, that's true.
Which was lovely. It was great that it would. Viral people love the sculpture, and if they really want to find who it is, they will.
So, did you contact them or anybody else?
Diplo?
Yeah.
No, I don't even know his music.
Yeah, but I mean, if somebody uses it, you can. I mean, that's what I'm sometimes doing is when I see something that's being appropriated in social media, I tell the people this is the artist. And then most of the times, these people are super happy because they didn't know, because there's so much things you see.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I could have told them, hey, it's me.
And then they're just like, oh, great. That's thanks. By the way, this is from the fantastic artist. And then, you know, sort of they get some interest. But yeah, but that's just a side effect. Yeah, but I mean, the smaller stuff you do, gallery shows, I think was it the first exhibition when you were in Germany with the Collab Gallery in Weil am Rhein?
Yes, the first time I came to Knotenpunkt here, it was probably my second time in Europe. It was very exciting.
Yeah. But that was the first time you traveled for your art into Europe.
Yes. Yes, when I met Fred.
Yeah.
That was the first time.
Fred from the Affenpost, one of the gallerists.
Yeah. He saw me at Collab Gallery and invited me. I got very excited. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Collab was pretty influential in the whole urban art scene because they were there in the beginning and they started out with money, which is pretty helpful in this business. Yeah, in this business, I mean.
Yeah, they could do whatever they wanted. Yeah. They didn't invite the very known artists. They invited the up and coming, and then they got this. Because so many of the artists picked up after that, they got this reputation of starting up artists. Mm-hmm. They did it completely organically.
I know. A good bunch of people. I met them in Switzerland, in Basel, a few years ago, really for the first time. I met them before, but that was really, really for the first time. And we got to talk and really interested in what they're doing. And they have a pretty free hand in what they're doing. So
they're great. I think that's pretty helpful. A little shout out to Stefan Wintel, who's showing at Knotenpunkt as well. His work is amazing.
I know, pretty good. Yeah, I mean, he's also one of the people that I would like to have on this podcast at some point, but it's, I probably could be recording one podcast a week if I want to get everyone on the podcast that I
want.
That was never the intention. But I'm super happy that this worked out with you now here. And you're still working on your work for the exhibition now?
Yes, yes. I'm not done. I will work all week. Yeah. I'll push as much work as I can.
When I see your, I mean, that's probably the way how we follow each other these days is by checking out what people are doing on social media. Your Instagram account is I think probably important for me to look at, but I don't see everything, of course. It's just, you know, too much these days. But it looks like you are working constantly and all the time, and most of the time in a different place in this world. Do you still have a studio back in Montreal?
Yeah, I still have a studio back in Montreal. Yeah, I travel a lot. Yeah. I don't stay in place. I'm invited to a lot of festivals and I like to travel so I just go. And so I stay maybe like 2-3 weeks in Montreal, then I leave again.
Okay.
Every month I'm in a different place.
So this festival circus that have started to build over the past years, is that still growing or is that at some point at a point where
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I feel that a lot of them kind of grew like mushrooms. Mm-hmm. Like they all popped up at the same time because there were these really cool events. Maybe it's slowing down a little bit. The big ones, the good ones, they stay on. Like mm-hmm. the powwows of this world are extremely relevant still. I'm going to Japan with powwow.
Okay. That started out somewhere in Hawaii, I think.
Yeah, no. They started right when it was needed. Mm-hmm. Jasper Wong that started that. Mm-hmm. And they started it. I remember it was very hot. Like, mm-hmm. oh my God, if you could be part of powwow, that's quite something. I remember also the mural festival in Montreal when it started like 7 years ago. It was, people were hungry for this. Mm-hmm. I think one of very old one that I never did, but very respected is the New Art Festival.
Mm-hmm. But that's been on for a while too.
Yeah, that's been, mm-hmm. and I did one in Sweden also. Oh, forget me, I can't remember the name. But it's every 2 years. So I think they're starting to do like biennales also, like stuff where, because it's expensive to make a festival, and then they want to take more time to produce something very powerful. But I don't know. I think there's less festival popping up here and there.
But when they invite you, do they pay you to come over? Is it just flight and accommodation, or you have your fee that you get?
It depends. It depends on the festival. It depends on the goal of the festival. There's festivals that have a lot of sponsors that are massive, and they will pay you. It's never a lot, but it's worth your time. Mm-hmm. And there's some festivals that are really doing it for the public. Mm-hmm. Often they, for example, powwow, they also often work with school or they mix projects for public projects. So it's like the goal of a powwow is not, it's not as much to make noise, but to work with the community. Mm-hmm. So no, powwows, they don't. Since they're not there to make money, everybody's there on their time, their mm-hmm. free time. Obviously, they pay your expenses though.
Yeah. Well, they should.
So, and then it makes you see a new part of the world. So it's quite nice. I like them. I respect the powwows a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to get actually in to keep track of all this when you're not as involved. I mean, I'm not involved in the urban art scene in the first place, but of course I look for
you
these things.
You watch it. Yeah.
As much as you can. It's not like you buy a magazine every month and you read through it and you
There's
know what
no
was happening.
Yeah.
You have to kind of get your information from your sources. There's a couple of newsletters that I still get and
newsletter.
I, yeah.
My God.
Yeah, you know what? I really, really think. And it's also going a little bit back to that at some points. Our newsletter here at Helium Core is pretty successful.
It's really?
Pretty good. Yeah, because I have direct interaction with people and it actually targets a lot of the people that are very important for my business. Yeah.
I don't think I've ever read a newsletter.
Yeah. No, it depends. I mean, what people probably wouldn't think today, you know, especially younger people, is that there are a lot of people out there who might be on Instagram, might be on Facebook, but are not using it at all. It always looks a little bit different because also Instagram and Facebook want this to look different, but there's a lot of people who are super inactive or not active at all. My most important collectors, I mean, for my art, I still send them PDF and JPEGs.
Well, okay, yeah, that's true.
And they, because 16. They don't know otherwise what I'm doing, because they're not going to look on the internet or on their phone or look on Instagram, and you know, so it's...
Yeah, my gallery in Montreal do send newsletter, and they always frame it well, like in capital letters, and makes you want to click on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I click on it often, and I don't even like, I'm not the target, right? I'm not buying there. I'm selling, but
yeah.
But they did it well. Okay, so I cannot mm-hmm. I can believe it works. All right.
I mean, there's a couple of galleries who do it really well, and I mean it's a good source to I mean it's about information hygiene, as you might call it. I mean I try to be on newsletters that I really want to read. I don't read them all the time, but if I have the time, if I'm sitting somewhere and reading my mail, emails and go through it and I get stuck, then this is actually helpful to me. And not always, you know, but there's newsletters that I read and I see nothing that interests me in there. But the next time there's something that keeps me to it. And there's big newsletters and small newsletters. And I personally still think I deliberately picked this newsletter to read. I mean, I'm not talking about the newsletters that you get in your spam mail. I'm just talking about especially art-related newsletters. And then after a while, if I get bored, I, you know, sort of unsubscribe. So I, for me, that is a good way to keep up with a little bit. And I have personally have the feeling that is something that, I mean, I don't send out newsletters often, probably once a month. If we have an exhibition like this one, we did 2 a month, because it's always a lot of work too, you know, to make one. It's easier to just post a picture and say, come around, we're open now, or here's the link to...
Well,
you know,
yeah.
So, but maybe I'm old fashioned, but I also use Instagram and all these things. But I know these things. I've learned how to use marketing, so I understand how this works.
Yeah, I haven't learned to use marketing.
Well, I mean, by
I'm not sure I'm really good at it.
But yeah, but I mean, you learned it by just going along with your career. You know,
yeah,
I think
you see what works,
yeah,
and what doesn't work.
That's what I mean. I never studied anything, so I didn't learn anything, but. That's in books. I just learned from life and from meeting people and seeing what works. And sometimes you don't know in the beginning of certain tools. You learn quickly how they work, and then they stop working that way, like Instagram or Facebook. It always changes. You kind of have to. It's what people sometimes, you know, sort of don't or underestimate is the time that when you have a gallery or when you're an artist or when you have an interest and maybe a professional interest in getting information out. It's not just the work you spend on your Instagram post that you're doing. It's also keeping up with the development, you know. I mean, it's like when stories began, you know, to unfold, a lot of people said, I don't need this. I don't want to film myself. And now a lot of people are actually doing this, and this is super successful. We have a lot more interaction with the story probably than you have with the post, you know, things like that. So you always have to keep up. But I mean, you probably exchange that as well with other artists that are on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I had an artist showing me how to use the stories properly or the request direct messages.
Yeah.
So I wasn't really checking those. I was just checking my messages, but I'd miss all the requested message, which was a little bad.
But I don't know. It's 80% spam, but I mean, yeah, sure. Or 50. You know, you have to. That's what I mean. It's a lot of work. You have to go through it.
Yeah, it's mostly like the fire emoji, you know, on your posts, which I don't care. On
it's
your
a beautiful
stories,
emoji fire.
Yeah, I know, right? but it's annoying because like I get like, yeah. I don't know 1,000, so it's like well, but in there was a lot of messages that was good for me to know to read and respond offers. So,
but do you do business over?
Sure.
Instagram, and that you get requests or
sure, yeah. A lot, often. I don't really sell directly.
No,
it's very rare. I will sell more through my galleries, depending on where the interested person lives. I send their email to my gallery that's in the area. And they send them a catalog of the available work. So then I don't have to deal with the shipping or the money or the invoice or anything. The gallery takes care of the negotiation.
Yeah, I know both sides. So I would appreciate if somebody was taking that off me too.
I mean, you do pay your galleries. Like it's not cheap,
sure.
But the time you spend, like of the amount of work I sell, like the time I would spend negotiating and coming back and forth with emails and shipment and timelines. No, I'm glad someone else is doing it. It's totally worth it.
Yeah, it's also not the only thing that a good gallery should do for you. That's just one part of how they make the money.
Yeah, that's
well,
just
you know,
one
so.
Part. Yeah.
But do you have multiple galleries, so like in different countries, and that represent you properly?
Yeah.
Okay. So
I have a few in Europe, in different countries, and in the US and in Asia.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Pretty good to have a network. They're all working together, or
Yeah, sure. Sometimes I make them exchange work because mm-hmm. they're interested by something and it's over there in England, or mm-hmm. they have a project that comes in, and everything is always on a short timeline. Mm-hmm. So I don't have the time to ship something to you. Madrid, for example. So then I'm like, well, I got some stuff in France, you know, and they could ship it to you. So they do work together.
Who are with you in France? Who are you with in France? Okay.
I'm with a gallery called L'œuf du 34. Uh-huh. It's in Paris. But I also have a lot of work in Bordeaux mm-hmm. for OBNL. I don't know if you call it like that in English. For a nonprofit organization that work with sustainability, everything. So they have a lot of monkeys.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I mean, just
And they have room to have it, mm-hmm. but I made them ship stuff back and forth mm-hmm. with England too.
Yeah.
So.
Yes, I think it's pretty good. I mean, I think this is also one. It's a good thing to work with several galleries across the globe, and hopefully they exchange in between, not just your work, but also, you know, kind of trying to I mean, the main goal of a gallery should be to help you grow, and I don't necessarily mean financially grow. I mean that you're able to continue your work and able to develop and be able to do things that you like to do, you know, in your artwork. I mean, if you want to do a really huge piece, you need your galleries to bring you to the point where somebody is willing to finance it and to show it and exhibit it, right? I mean,
the galleries I have, they're people I chose, because I changed mm-hmm. gallery a few times. Mm-hmm. So those, it's because they're not necessarily big, but they have honest, genuine people that work in it.
Yeah.
So and I get along. So whenever they have a project, yeah, they bring it to me, or a commission, and all of them together, that's enough to mm-hmm. to make me live. And come once in a while to Europe.
So in Germany, is this Affenfaust responsible for you, or is just the Knotenpunkt Festival, or did you do a solo show with them so far?
No, I've only done the Knotenpunkt with Affenfaust, but yeah, I guess they are responsible for me. The thing is, I don't produce enough to keep a constant flow of new work to my different galleries. So now I've never shipped work to Affenfaust. I think I meant to in the last 5 years, but since I decided to travel and to make work on sites I never had enough. I never had time to build a body of work.
But do you do solo exhibitions, or is that something that doesn't...
Yeah, every year somewhere. Like, I'm going to have one in December, I think, in Montreal.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm trying to travel a little less now because I need to produce a body of work, like real... Mm-hmm. Not just festivals and
because that's a danger of it, right?
Oh yeah, it gets addictive, and you end up like hopping from places to places. And in a way, like it's fantastic because you get better at figuring out stuff. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like building giant work in 2 weeks or in 1 week, so you learn to make do, to fix, but at the same time, you don't experiment because you always work on something you know, because you're always stuck in time. So now I'm looking forward to go back home mm-hmm. and experiment on new work and new ways to show. And I need to be home for that. I need to take the time to do that.
Yeah, I think it's sometimes important that you sometimes take you out of the picture a little bit, to be on your own and be able to, you know, develop things that are don't have where you're not always constantly under the influence of others, you know, where you're not seen. I mean, at least that's for me. I think it's important to be in the studio and just work away for me and not necessarily showing anything to anyone except, you know, the friends and family that come around. That's nice.
I need to give myself the right to fail. Mm-hmm. Because when you work, like right now for Affenfaust, I'm not going to fail. I'm not going to make one bad mm-hmm. work because I don't have time.
Yeah.
So I need to go back into the studio and allow myself to do something horrible, mm-hmm. disgusting, throw it away, break it in pieces, throw it in the garbage and start over, because I will have tried something new and you never know how it's going to come out.
Yeah. So there's no time to experiment when you're on the road.
No, it's not the time. Mm-hmm. It's not the time to do that.
It's also not what people are expecting of you.
No. Yeah, that's it. They ask you to come and they're like, make as many work as you can. And we like this and this and this. No, it's not the time. You're not there to try new things. You're there to present what you know you're the best at.
Mm-hmm. And you're holding a pretty unique position because there's not many other cardboard artists around.
No.
At least not on those. I mean, no, a couple of.
Yeah, there is. But I said that you don't experiment, but at the same time, I never do the same sculptures, right?
Yeah.
So like just at this show, all the shapes that are there, the forms, I've never done them before. It's not really what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
There's not that many cardboard artists out there. There is, though. There is some really good ones. Mm-hmm. But so far, there's not that many. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, I've been working with a very early, very good cardboard artist doing something completely different than you, Boris Hoppeck. I've been working with him for many years.
Is he German?
He's German, yeah. Well, he lives in Barcelona since 2002, 2003. Okay. He likes it warm. He likes it where he can take a surfboard to the beach. I mean, that's the thing. If you are an artist and you're living a life that has no protection in a way as well, you should, you know, sort of be try to create the environment that you need to work in. And if that means that you can go out on the surfboard from time to time, then that's good. If that means that you just want to stay inside in the dark, that's also good. But you have to find a way that's best for you to create. Well, what you want to create, you know, what's inside you.
I never thought really about whether, but I guess it's because I'm Canadian. So you just have to make do, you know, if you start dreaming about hot beaches, you'll just be unhappy. My dream was always to have a large studio. Mm-hmm. That's all I want.
Yeah, well, that's probably the what every artist desires.
Yeah.
It's like a place to
don't care about
do
the
that.
Rest.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want a giant space to work in.
Yeah.
I'm not there yet.
Yeah, but it's expensive. It's harder and harder to find. I mean, look at a city like Hamburg, and it grew in the last years. Also, there's a. I personally have the feeling there are much more artists than there were 10 years ago or 15 years ago. I mean, today,
yeah,
there's
I don't
so
know.
Many artists.
Do you think?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
It's so much easier to live off of your art now with internet than it was before. I mean, I remember my orienter teachers at school telling me it would be better to go with study history than arts. Can you imagine that? That's so much worse now.
Yeah, but I still don't think that most artists make money with their art and will not do so for a long time. I mean, maybe if you're in this circle of the powwow and everything, you're surrounded by artists that are successful. But I mean, there's still a majority of the artists is not financially successful.
I don't think that's true. With Etsy, nah. Now there's ladies that make belt buckles and they live, you know?
Yeah.
And Etsy sells enough.
So how good can you live off belt buckles?
Well, you have to invite them on your podcast to know.
Well, I don't know. I think I have a pretty good understanding of the art world and of the art scene and how it works. And I know that there's a lot of artists who don't make enough money to come by. And it has always been the case and it will always be the case because you don't produce anything that has any kind of sustainable future in a way, unless you're represented by good galleries or are part of.
You can sell on Etsy and like find your niche.
You can make some money with it. That's true.
Yeah. No. Okay. Do they make a lot of money? No. Do they make the salary of a McDonald's worker? Sure.
Yeah, if they're lucky, yeah.
I don't know. See, I'm talking through my... I have no idea.
I know a lot of artists and I know most of them have jobs.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Even though the ones that are represented by galleries and they're still doing work because it's also galleries these days don't sell in the bulk that they're actually there, you know. I mean, there's a lot of galleries, but there's also not the market that it was like before, I don't know, between 2002 and 2008. It's a different market now. It's different. I mean, there's a lot of galleries that went out of business and there's a lot of galleries who probably should be out of business when you look at their numbers, but they just keep the fight up, or they have, as the people like to say, a fuel tank in the basement through some money they already have and they don't necessarily care.
I mean, maybe they don't work hard enough.
I don't think that. I mean, yeah, I know a lot of galleries who had to close their shop and they were hard workers.
Yeah, because I have the vision of the artist, right? And there's a lot of galleries that they waste their time. They wait for people to walk in from the street. That's not the way it works.
No.
They're slow. Mm-hmm. They're not proactive. Mm-hmm. And what I find is that the young galleries, the one I have, they work hard. Like, they're very proactive. Mm-hmm. They go out. They go talk to people.
Gotta be active.
They travel.
Sure.
They fight hard. But I've been approached by a lot of like galleries that are like, yeah, come with us. Like, we sell so much. And yeah, they did in 2002. Yeah. But they just, they just wait. They just wait around and you're supposed to bring everything. And
yeah, but that's, I mean, yeah, okay. Everybody
but
has
that was
different,
my vision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody has a different concept of how to run a gallery. I think the galleries that do exist and that actually get some work out, they manage to sell and they are active because they can't afford to just wait around because they have rent to pay. They have if they go on fairs, they have fairs to pay. They have a lot of money that they have to make before they just all spend it, you know. But I think there's no transparency in this business at all. Like, you would not be on a fair and you talk to another gallery and they would do shit business and they would tell you that they're doing shit business. Most of them are like, oh, it was great. And oh no, we didn't sell today, but we had met this great curator or collector or whatever. I think there's a lot of talk out there. I think there's also, but probably like in most businesses, not enough honesty. There doesn't have to be, because everybody is personally responsible for how they do their business. It sometimes amazes me that there are so many galleries still going to art fairs, that there are art fairs that work and that there are galleries that work. I don't object to that. But I think that the amount of art fairs there are and the amount of galleries that go there, I don't think that they're all going to make their money back. Just think about what a fair costs you and how do you get that money back through
sales. I think it works, though, because they wouldn't go otherwise.
Yeah, but I mean, just the definition of what works is also something that that you will not be, you know, sort of, you will not be able to look behind the facade. And I know a lot of people. And when we talk, most of them are pretty honest about these things. But it's a decision that you have to make. Like, if you run a gallery and you're excluding yourself from fairs, you're excluding yourself from a potential portion of the market. That doesn't mean that if you go to these fairs that you make money. I also know galleries that have gone to the fairs, they tried everything else, they're making good money with their sales. They're making good work for the artist, but they decided against going to fairs because it just takes out so much money that they have available every year to invest into their artist, because they're just on fucking fairs in Miami and everybody looks good and everybody talks about something. But like, for example, in Miami, most of the art fairs, the galleries don't sell. Bottom line, that's it. They don't sell. And however they manage to get by, that's their thing. Usually through sales that they make through their clients back at home or other kind of projects, or as I said, or they have the money, or they just, I don't know, they just, you know, so different. But it is very difficult to make enough money for all the artists and for all the projects. I know for the Hamburg situation, Hamburg is not the best market. We have a market, it's not the best market, and everybody's basically trying to get the same collectors to come by to your gallery and buy, if you're looking for local galleries, collectors. So it's difficult, you know. Yeah, it's real.
Who
so
everybody gets the nice customer and who gets the nicest artist? That's your job. You have to be so good at what you do that you get the best artists and you get the best collectors, right? Yeah.
So but
it's honestly, like high school.
How's that like high school?
Yeah, well, I mean, life is like high school. It's just,
yeah.
I was pretty good in high school.
You were pretty good in high school, huh? Well, I think there's still a big portion of being at the right place at the right time, having luck, meeting the right people, being professional. That's probably the most important thing on both sides.
That's hard for some people.
Yeah, of course. Especially when you're in a
Oh, I think art fairs.
Obviously, from the outside looking easy business, you know, like it's, everything's beautiful, everything's colorful.
I think art fairs are a very important, though, step for the artists.
Mm-hmm. And sure.
I think it's like you can see it as a conference, like about, like, you know, this. There's this conference in Montreal called C2 Montreal, and it's all about creativity and business. Mm-hmm. And businesses pay like thousands and thousands of dollars to send their employees for 3 days over there. But it creates teamwork. It creates whatever it bring, whatever they bring back is worth it, because they keep spending 10, 20, 30 grand to send their their employees and their CEOs over there. So... Miami is the same thing.
Well, an art fair in the first place is a trade show. It's a place where galleries put up artwork for sale, because that's it's a marketplace. And I think that is just basically what an art fair is. It's very good for, it can be very good for the career of artists to be part of art fairs. But you have to also be, again, at the right art fair, you know.
But you do many. I mean, you don't just do Miami. Miami is one of them. And Miami is fun, but it's also intense. And you don't need to go to one of the art fairs in Miami. There's, for example, you'd be better off doing a trade show in China right now, which I did, and it was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
There's also art fairs, because everything's moving, right? So there's also, art fairs are big, but you could do Comic-Con, for example, which people look down on this, but Comic-Con is intense. People are way more into Comic-Cons than into art fairs. Mm-hmm. And when you go there, I have a friend that started doing it, like by himself, because an art fair, you can't do it as an artist. Mm-hmm. It has to be a gallery, right? But a Comic-Con, for example, you can go as an artist and just sell your work. And he says he sold like he never did before. Mm-hmm. So there's also like trade shows about in LA about different things. And I saw some of my friends like Graflex or I can't name another artist, but that do more like cartoonish work. Mm-hmm. A bit like me, like the series of cartoons I made. And they went to this trade show. And there was galleries there, and they sold like they never did in an art fair. So like things are moving around, and it's not just a shit show. It's very stimulating for people to go there.
Sure,
it's an investment, but well, the galleries I know, they if they don't make their money, they're close to. So I mean, it was in the end, it was a bit of money and time, and. They made so much contacts, and they met other artists, and they were present where it mattered for 4 days. You know, so in the end, what is it like? It's no big deal.
As I said, you have to be strategic about it when you run a business like a gallery. You can't go to just to Miami to do a fair. You have to go.
Well, you can't do
if
them
you go
all.
To Miami. No, but you can't do
you
the wrong one. You have to
choose.
Do the right one. You have to be able to get in. As I said, being strategic about what is the goal of your gallery. Is the goal of your gallery to sell cartoon artists? Then fine, you should go to Comic-Con. If the goal of your gallery is to sell a different kind of art, you have to find the right art fair for that. The point with art fairs is always you have to look into not just how professionally the art fair is handled, but also who is going and who is visiting the art fair. Are museums visiting the art fair and looking for artists and galleries to collaborate with? Are really important collectors going there, or good collectors, not important collectors, but good collectors going there? And that's something you have to find out as a gallery, and I think that's your responsibility. There's no use in spending 30, 40, 50,000 euros on and going to an art fair that is just a good party for 4 days and then leaving frustrated and leaving everybody frustrated, your artists as well.
Well, that's the thing though. If you're a good businessman, you found out which art fairs were the best for you.
Yeah, it's just getting also a little bit, you know, confusing and very hard to stay close to all of this. I think
it's not hard. Come on, light up a little bit.
No. I mean, it's not about me. I mean, for me, it's okay. I mean, I think if you do this professionally, you have to invest a lot of time and a lot of a resource on that. If you just think, oh, I'm going to this fair and I'm taking these artists because they're currently hip. I mean, how many galleries these days choose their artists because they have 50,000 followers on Instagram and don't take the artist that actually has something to say, or has probably 500 or is not even on Instagram? I think the purpose of gallery, I mean, not every gallery, probably not, maybe not Affenfoss, even though I believe they think the same, is find artists that are relevant, that you believe that are relevant, that you personally feel are important to show. I'm showing with Helium Cowboy, I've always just shown artists that I personally believe in.
Well, and, I mean, I think
and then
most
you have
galleries
to think,
are like that too. I don't believe.
Yeah, but then you have to think how can you actually build something that creates some sustainability also for the career of the artist. And I think if you want to do that, then you're doing a good job. But that is, I think only if, I mean, I've been talking to other galleries as well, and there's one, and to directors of museums and stuff. And there's one thing that is getting, that is, you know, so a type of gallery that is getting less and less important, has gotten less and less important these past years, are galleries with a program. And I don't mean by program, I mean, don't mean like 10 shows a year. I mean, like, what is your program? What are you standing for? What are you showing? Do you take an artist on and develop the artist for 5, 6, 7 years before you have the first real serious sale? And, you know, sort of, and that is something when you start a gallery, you have to always allocate your resource to the artist. And then you have one artist that you probably, I mean, I worked with performance artists, so you know how difficult it is to get money for performance artists. But then the other artists that were more successful had to basically get enough money in so that I could afford to promote this artist, you know, and to do those things. So it's a very intense business if you want to do it right. And
I don't know, I'm not a gallerist.
Yeah, and I think that is, then it's a privilege if you're an artist and work to have, you know, able to work with one of these galleries, you know, because then it's a common understanding of the same goal. And also one thing that is very, very important, I mean, for me has always been important, doesn't work out all the way that in that sense, but it's artists and galleries should be a team. They should understand that they're basically working on the same barbecue and one brings the meat and the other one brings the beer. And it's, especially these days, I think it's very, very important that both understand that they're in the same boat. And that if you do a fair, that the artists show up and help you, you know, if you don't make enough money with the artist to supply a setup crew, you know. These galleries, of course, they work differently. But I think these are things that are important for a relationship between an artist and a gallery. There has to be a relationship and not just you take my work and sell it or vice versa.
I think all my galleries, we have this relationship.
Yeah. I think it's important.
Otherwise, it doesn't work anyway.
Yeah. 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 I just think it's a different kind of market that we're also looking at now than we've been looking at 3 years ago or 10 years ago and 20 years ago, and it will be a different market when we look at it in 5 years ago. I think there's a lot of changes, and maybe after this development right now nothing has changed and everything goes back to how it was, and because that starts to work again. But I think it's a different, what you need to find now out now today is how do you get people actually interested in, not interested in the art, but also interested in sustaining it. You know,
you think people are not interested in sustaining art?
Well, they have to be able to do that by not just likes and followers, but also by investing into art and into artists and into galleries. I think there's less than there were, or different than there were.
Well, I wouldn't know because I've been in the business for what, 7, 10 years now. So when I graduated from school, it was 2009, 2010. So like the world of gallery had already changed,
because
of the crash and because of so I think for me it was never really an issue though.
Mm-hmm.
I selling is not easy, but it's not also the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, so there's no lack of interest, but there is lack of space sometimes. That's why we had a art fairs in New York for a while. And then one of my galleries at some point was like, oh, we're not doing art fairs in New York. There's no space.
On the fairs?
No, in the fairs there is, but like he's like, I went to have a coffee with one of our customers once. He's a millionaire. He brought us to his like studio, his house. Mm-hmm. It's tiny. He can't fit anything in there. There's no space in New York. And it's true when you think of it. It's one of the most clustered city in the world. And so he's like, even the millionaires have no room. There was no room for anything. Mm-hmm. So now they do the art fairs other places. Yeah. See? So it's a good market, but physically people cannot fit shit in their house. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was interesting.
So now it's better to go to... Los Angeles, or is that better? California?
Probably. That gallery ended up showing in Miami very successfully, and they go there every year now. They change art fairs, though. Mm-hmm. So we'll see, because different art fairs.
Who's the gallery?
Oh, Station 16.
Okay.
Yeah, and so now it's Miami all the way. Mm-hmm. They love that place. Mm. When you're a Canadian gallery, too, I mean, there's art fairs in the US, but going to Europe, for example, is... very complicated. Mm-hmm. So they don't do art fairs in New York.
Yeah.
And if you do art fairs in the US, I think Miami is the best one. Mm-hmm. And it's only like, it's not very far from Montreal. It is, but not really.
Yeah, I think the whole traveling from, European galleries have always been a bit more open to the concept of going to a fair in the United States, because it also is very important to go there. I mean, we went there.
But that's crazy. You have to fly.
If the business is there, you have to go where the business is. And,
yeah, exactly.
And it was for us also was really, really good for many years to go there.
But I mean, before Brexit, the art fairs in London were great. I mean, the galleries, I remember galleries and artists in England with the pounds, like doing marvelously. Mm-hmm. And Paris too, even though Paris probably doesn't have much more room than New York. I have a few galleries that do art fairs in Paris every year because it's good. I don't know about Art Basel.
Basel, yeah.
And I've never done a fair in Germany, but France has a lot of fairs. Apparently it's not bad at all.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, Paris just became a fair city. It's not that long ago that they were not really relevant on the map of art fairs. But with the exponential growth of art fairs over the past 12 years or so, 10, 12 years, Paris has become much more important. And Paris it's also a question of the destination. Same, the success of Miami, of course, has something to do with that the Art Basel, the biggest art fair in the world, decided to go there, but it's also a very nice destination to go to. So collectors travel there. It's a thing. Collectors like to travel to Paris.
Yeah, I don't know why that ended up in Miami, eh?
Yeah, but that's one of the reasons, you know, is because
it's nice, because it's warm, because there was room probably, and then the other satellite art fairs gathered around, and then it became this big thing, giant thing. But
if the biggest fair in the world, the Art Basel, goes to Miami, that is, of course, a starting point for something big. So they don't do many mistakes. They also went to Hong Kong and, you know,
I think it didn't become a giant thing yet in Hong Kong, right? Because it's hard to travel there. Just shipping work to China is complicated. Yeah.
You need a visa. Yeah, but if you follow up on galleries that actually go to Hong Kong, and these are pretty good galleries that are profitable, that understand their way around these years. And
of course,
if you follow up on those things that go there and you see that it's important, the fair in Hong Kong is... who was I talking to? Fair in Hong Kong. The Art Basel in Hong Kong is more important than the Art Basel right now. Maybe different next year. It's definitely more important than the one in Miami right now. So, I mean, following all these trends, I mean, it's not from my personal experience. It's from what I read and what I hear from other galleries and from the market. So,
but it's much harder for the artists to just show up in Hong Kong than to just show up in Miami.
Yeah.
So... it's not yet this free space where you can...
That's true.
Also, Miami became, because of the whole Wynwood thing, it became this...
For urban art, yeah.
Yeah, for urban art, it became the Mecca. Mm-hmm. Where Hong Kong, good luck, before it becomes like an urban art
But Hong Kong is maybe not for urban art.
No.
I think there's still a big difference about this. Miami was just that because there was so much space, and then this urban art festival Wynwood developed, you know, sort of could only probably develop there and had nothing to do with the Art Basel going there. They didn't plan on having a big urban art festival next to their fair.
Well, yeah, but you know. China is not bored with urban art yet.
Yeah.
The way Europe mm-hmm. and the US definitely mm-hmm. are. So I love going to China. Mm-hmm. Every time I go, like it opens my eyes to so many things, like a young,
I believe
fresh,
that. Yeah.
and I mean, they don't like it the same way mm-hmm. that the US like it. Like they don't like murals. Like there's a superstitious, I think, thing that goes with it.
It's also a different history of vandalism. Yeah,
different yeah. everything, right? Yeah. So they don't, but they love all the colorful, cartoonish, playful. Mm-hmm. They like the playful. And like I said, not bored with it. So it's, I think it's the next place to go.
Yeah,
Asia,
but it already is. I mean, it already is for the art world. It's very important that and people. I mean, look at Magda Danis, one of the very first galleries. She started in Paris when we started with Helium Cobra in Germany,
I've met her.
She was very, very into graffiti and urban art from the beginning. Is still holding true to that, and she has a space in Shanghai, I think, for 6-7 years already.
Yeah, she did like years ago when mm-hmm. I went to her gallery.
She's a very smart girl and woman. She really saw the benefit of how China develops, and it was a big risk probably at that time. But now it's just like it's great for art. I just don't believe that urban art will ever have as much meaning in a country that has basically banned, prohibited, and punished public vandalism from the beginning. I mean,
it's completely different.
So, but urban art doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the whole history of graffiti and of the vandalism part of the whole thing. You know, what you see today on these festivals has got nothing to do with the vandalism of the 80s, 90s, train riding, you know, sort of all these things.
No. Oh no, thank God. But no, it doesn't have the same feeling at all. But at the same time, like you know, galleries over there are situated in malls, mm-hmm. right? It doesn't have, malls are not that dirty thing that it is here.
Mm-hmm.
Here, if you show in a mall, like that's really sad.
Yeah, it's
but
sad.
In China,
yeah,
that's what cause does.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not urban art, but it's entangled into urban culture mm-hmm. and consumerism, like in a much deeper way. It looks gross for us, but it, but it is awesome for that they like that. It's another country. It's another story, and then we'll get there and it's
totally another different culture.
You do something different. You mm-hmm. approach your art in a different way mm-hmm. over there, for sure.
It's also exciting to be part of it right now. I think. I mean, the last time I was in China, or the only time I was in China, was 1994.
It's so
a lot
same
of things have changed.
There was no,
it's a different country.
94.
Yeah. I traveled there a couple of months.
You got to go there again. You know, you don't need to be vaccinated the same way.
No, you didn't need to be vaccinated. You just need to have a tough stomach.
Yeah. I only went to Beijing though. Mm-hmm. And I didn't go in rural areas. I did stay in the outskirts of Beijing, so it was a little different. But I didn't have like a cultural shock that mm-hmm. you probably had in 94. Or if I went to little villages and stuff like that. Same thing with Korea. I went to Seoul.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Seoul is very easy to navigate when you speak English.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. But I mean, it's interesting in countries that you're actually being able to travel to now.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
And except like you can see like the waitress or the people that works in stores like ducking under the counter because they see you and they're like, shit, I'll have to speak English. And they hide. because you're white, right? I'm white. So I've never been really, before going there, I've never been like a visible minority.
Yeah.
And now, of course, I don't speak Korean. They assume that mm-hmm. I will not speak Chinese or Korean. They're like, shit.
Yeah, but I mean, they're still hand and feet to talk, you know? I mean, I think that's...
Oh, they end up talking. It's fine. Mm-hmm. They know the basics.
Yeah, I think it's that's exciting that that the whole of Asia is now part of this too. I mean, it has been part of the art world before, but in a totally on a total different level, and now it's getting more exciting.
Oh yeah, when I work in China with his name is Ivan, mm-hmm. and he has such a fresh eye, and he looks at Instagram and he's like, "Who's this artist? I'm not sure I like his work," and it's a really giant artist, you know, mm-hmm. or he looks at the tiniest artist and he's like, "Oh, I like this. I'll invite him." That guy probably never was invited mm-hmm. anywhere because he does not look at who that person is. Mm-hmm. He looks at just what he likes and he likes very different things than you and me.
But that is also one of the things we should put on the list. What a good gallerist should bring is keep an open mind and not be influenced by Instagram likes or what people think. I mean, there's a lot of the big artists.
Definitely not. He's big artists
that I don't like either. You know, yeah.
I like that a lot.
Yeah, yeah, I know. But I mean, it's also It's also time for a different generation, a different approach of artists and galleries. Or people just artists. Yes, that's a simple job title, but or job description. But the rest is there's different jobs now in this art world that have never been there. I mean, people who organize these festivals, they're not art dealers or art or curators or in the classical sense or gallerists or whatever. They have their own job description. They're managing huge projects and they're. You know, so I think there's a totally new approach to art that has come basically, you know, that's the thing. The crisis may have been bad for many galleries, but it also has been pretty good, I think, for the whole urban art scene because it could focus on something else and not just be taken into the circus that it was before, you know.
It reshuffled the cards, mm-hmm. yeah. Like my most successful galleries are the ones that find projects. Like mm-hmm. they go out there, they find like, I don't know, a company of something or mm-hmm. And they're like, "Laurence, do you want to do this giant thing?" But it's a lot of work and they're mm-hmm. they end up like not doing the job of a gallerist per se, mm-hmm. this by description.
Yeah.
They end up being project managers, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And to be honest, like I haven't heard anyone complaining about that kind of thing. Like a gallerist loves managing a giant project.
Of course.
And so
you can write an invoice.
You can write an invoice, but you're also outside of your gallery.
Yeah, sure.
You're on your phone. You're talking with this and that, talking about transportation,
much more exciting,
resources.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's not boring. Mm-hmm. It's not the same thing.
Yeah.
Like I guess that's what I meant by like, mm-hmm. Successful gallery not being lazy. It's not lazy to sit at your but
I know
the
what
job
you mean.
Description
yeah.
is completely different mm-hmm. than it was.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, for me, for example, I told you when we met last week, I have been changing what Helium Cowboy, well, not necessarily what Helium Cowboy stands for. That has always been the same because that's basically just me, you know, sort of doing what I think is important and that I want to do. At that time, but I'm not a gallery anymore in the sense, but I'm still doing gallery shows from time to time. But that's not my main focus. I'm tired of hanging artworks, including mine. But that's okay, you know, that's fine. It's just the exhibition looks really, really good that we're having on right now, but that is because I brought fresh blood and fresh eyes into this space and try to enable other people on both sides, not just the artists, but you know, so people who install to look at it differently. But I try to focus on different things that are more important and more relevant to me. And
poor artist.
No, I mean, super happy with. I mean, it's the best gallery he can find. Why? Because I'm not putting a nail in the wall.
No, because you don't seem really motivated to.
I do one show in six months. That's how much motivated I am with this one show. Has more attention than any other exhibition you can get. I have time to work for this. I have time to work with the artist. I have time to find the right people. I have time to develop this. I help an artist by, you know, sort of not just, "Hey, do you want to make an exhibition in 3 months after that one, before that one?" It's a different approach that I have. I don't think I'm able now with all the things that I'm doing. I mean, the podcast is one side thing, but I'm an artist first and foremost, and I've allowed myself to dedicate the majority of my time to my art over the past years. now and going away from being a full-time gallerist with two jobs at the same time. So now that I'm focusing on my art, I just think it's unfair to show five artists a year, but it's totally fair to show one.
Sure.
That's what I mean, you know? So it shifts. And I think it's also okay to say I'm not showing you because I'm not motivated to show you. I would not show anyone that I'm not motivated in. And then there is it's a different approach to new exhibitions, how they can be done. And so, as I told you before, the podcast is for me is part of the gallery work now, because I help people to, I mean, I don't have to help you to get recognized, but there's a lot of people who are going to listen to this and say, ah, that's how she's doing. Ah, okay, that's what I'm getting into. Oh, okay. So they get a, you know, sort of get a perspective on this. So I think that's also a way of how to work today, you know, because we're not just having the Instagram post of us sitting here in front of the microphones. People have to listen 1 hour. They can listen 1 hour to what we have to say. So it's a lot more.
Do you think they will?
Hmm? Yeah, you it's you take your time, you spend some time. And I think that's the most important, most valuable asset that we have is time. And what do we do with it?
I wanted to be part of this podcast because I listen to podcasts all day, every day.
Yeah, I think
when
it's
I work.
Mm-hmm.
So art podcasts are good. Matt Gondek has a really
yeah,
good
yeah, I had Matt Gondek
too.
On the show.
Did you?
Yeah, I talked to him.
Amazing. He's a mm-hmm. he's a great guy.
Yeah.
I like him a lot.
Yeah, it's funny. I just came across his when I was doing the podcast. I mean, this year I was doing the podcast for over a year and I never heard of his podcast. And I came across his podcast and thought, well, that's pretty cool because he's, you know, in a way he has the same curiosity.
Wait, let's make sure we say the name of the podcast. What is it again?
The Clean Break Podcast.
Clean Break, that's right. So go listen to that.
Clean Break Podcast, yeah. And it was a good talk, you know. And it's important that you have podcasts like that out there because I think the majority of my listeners is also probably artists.
Hopefully. I don't know. Yeah, probably, yeah.
Yeah.
Or people that are interested in everything.
Yeah, yeah.
I listen to a lot of science podcasts.
Yeah.
I didn't think I was ever interested in science, but when it's well put together, everything is fantastic. Like I learned a lot about dinosaurs lately. Mm-hmm. Loved it.
Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about doing this podcast, for example, doing it with different people, there are so many opinions that you get at this one table or over the internet because some of them I do remotely, you know, once with, I can't talk to Matt Gondek here in Hamburg, so we spoke over the internet. And you get totally different perspectives from different people. When I talk with Jonathan Levine, for example, about the gallery scene and how it has developed, we've been in it the same amount of time. We've been on similar fairs. We made similar experiences. And last week I spoke with, or a few weeks ago, I spoke with Harlan Levy, who does a gallery in Brussels, completely different approach, completely different perspective also on the art market. And that is the diversity that you can bring into a podcast with a topic, because everybody probably thinks it's simple. It's paintings in a gallery, you know, but there's so many different aspects of it. And everyone, I think that Affenfaust can do a project like Knotenpunkt still means they've done something right, which they probably even haven't figured out themselves, but you know, maybe they did, whatever. They went through a lot of changes over the course of time. They're still doing this. Other galleries that, they have made different experiences and different learnings and probably have a different approach than another gallery that, you know, sits in Berlin or in Montreal that, you know, targets the same people. So no matter who you sit with, you get different opinions. And this is the same with you when you travel to these festivals. There's artists who, I mean, I've also spoken to a couple of artists who go on to these festivals. They do not want to come on my podcast because they are there, but they don't like being there. That also exists. What I mean, it's like a totally diverse meaning. They think it's important for their career to be there, but it's killing them on a health level and on everything. And they don't like seeing their large murals on 28 meter high ceilings, that walls that in the end just only on Instagram. You know, that brings me to one of my last topics. Let's get away from that. How important is print for you?
Print.
Do you have a book coming out? Do you plan on doing a book? Is there already catalogs for your work?
No. That there is a book where I'm part of, which is The Art of Cardboard by mm-hmm. Laurie Zimmer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Okay, Laurie, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I know that book.
I love Laurie. So she wrote this book, I think think it's The Art of Cardboard that I should check. she dedicated a little part of it for me and other cardboard artists.
Yeah, I remember.
That's great. And that's the only book. I haven't made a book yet. I should start thinking about that.
I think it's time. It's very valuable for artists to have a book, also for the galleries.
I'm not much of a writer. I do not like to write.
No, I think one of your galleries should actually take the lead and say, Laurence, we need that book. I mean, you're in the business now, what did you say, 7 years? So I think it's about fucking time that you get a print. Because the thing with the book is, it's what we talked about, the sustainability and things that.
I'd love to have one of those coffee table books, hardcover. A nice with beautiful photos kind of thing. That's something I'll think about. You know, taking photos of the work is something I often skip.
Really?
Yes. It's bad, eh?
It's bad. It's probably rule number one in the how to become a successful artist. Document your work. Get a decent camera.
Rule number one. I have a decent camera.
Yeah.
That's now 15 years old.
Yeah. Okay. Well, but still.
So is it still decent? No, this is the hard part. Like taking raw pictures, good enough to put them in a book. It's rough. It's tough. Listen, I just moved studio and I, for the first time, installed a photo booth, which is, my sculptures are really big, right? So I need something really large. So I never had that before.
Yeah.
And it's a pity.
Yeah, it's important.
So I feel bad, but it's not the part that I like. And I'm always in a rush. I'm always rushing to pack up the work and ship it or to deliver it somewhere or to, you know.
I know, I understand.
So I often skip the photo part for sure.
Well, me coming from a background, I haven't worked as a photographer when I was really young. Of course, photography is important to me and I still use it in an old fashioned sense. But documenting the work process, documenting exhibitions, that's all fair and fine. But doing the actual reproductions of my work, and I have a photo booth as well. I have all these things to, you know, sort of also do this for the artists that exhibit here quite often. That is like making taxes. That's like doing my taxes.
Right?
I hate it. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't even like making like white collar balance.
I'm with you there.
Listen, for the first time in my life, like last month, I had enough space to take actual photos of the work. For the first time. I was, before my first studio, I was sharing it with 12 people. I'm sure a lot of people can relate to me on that. And the second one was in a factory type of place. Very dirty, but free. And was there a white space? No, there was no white space to take photos of my work. So I take good enough photos for Instagram, but for a book, no. I miss that. It's confession time.
Yeah. I think it's just important that people know that the photos they do for Instagram, if they do them for Instagram, try to make the same quality that you can put them in the book later on. I mean, not everybody will make a book, but I mean... I think
if there's an artist
important.
Listening, don't do that. Do it properly.
Yeah.
Document it. It's just even like when I travel, for example, often I will meet a photographer and they will take some pictures and send it to me, but it gets scattered in my emails or in my computer. But I have them. Yeah. So I have pictures out there. But if I really wanted to, now I'm working on, I want to make a small documentary and
film.
Yeah. And just flying in it. And I've had this idea for a long time. I've had offers, like people really wanting to do it. But what would be interesting would be to travel with me. Paying a film crew to go with you. It's expensive. I could never pay the ticket. Like I need an assistant to build the work, but paying an assistant to film you know,
I know
it feels vain, and I could never afford it before. And so that's it. It's all part of the.
But you're doing it now, or the documentary?
Yeah. We're really at the beginning. Mm-hmm. But
film is also very important. That's true. Film is important. But this, you know, if we're just on the teaching part of this podcast, what you just said with your photos, it's great when you have photographers out there taking pictures and you're on great festivals and they're great photographers. I know a couple of them. I mean, not personally, but their work and they, you know, they do really good stuff, you know, and document great photos. But the thing is, if you ever want to do a book, make sure that moment that you have access to these photos, that you own them. So make an arrangement with a photographer. What happens then? I'll just have photos in your email, you know. So it's very important when you go to a publisher at some point.
Make sure I don't forget and you have who like send
50
it to me.
Photographers who have to clear rights with.
Oh, yeah.
It's also a nightmare.
And I need to give them credits too because they deserve it.
Well, they deserve that. Yeah.
So now I lately I got a little better at that because I like my last trip to Miami, I made a really good friend with Nika Krama. Does that sound familiar? She's an amazing photographer in Berlin. Mm-hmm. And she was also in Miami. So we did work together. Mm-hmm. So she did great for me. But when you think of it, like my sculpture was so big.
Yeah.
And I wanted to, it was a fallen horse. It was a horse trying to get up.
I saw that,
You saw that? Mm-hmm. And I wanted to take it in the middle of the street. So we had to transport it there. Like I had to make an appointment. I had to find guys to transport the horse. And then we would go back and forth between the street and the sidewalk while, you know, the lights were on, right? Like that when someone had a red light. And so it was fun, but it took the afternoon, right?
Yeah, why can't go photo takes time.
Again, sure. Like I'm just trying to find excuses to not do it.
All right, Laurence, anything we've missed? Well, definitely we missed a lot of things, but anything you...
Punkt. When is the vernissage?
Oh, it's on Thursday, but the podcast will come out later after
that. Oh, okay, okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's going to be on for a little while, so...
Yeah, it's also, you know, sort of, I think the good thing about podcasts is that they have no expiration date because most of the things we spoke about will still be relevant in a year. There will be probably a next Knotenpunkt and there will be probably different festivals. And people, fortunately, not just only listen to me in Hamburg or to us. So, but there will be definitely, but what's the best way to keep up with where you're at and where to see you?
On Instagram.
What's the handle?
Laurence Vall, so LAURENCEVAL.
All right.
So that's my Instagram handles. That's the only thing I keep updated.
Yeah, but it's good. I mean, it's fine. Just one channel is enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that is very, everything in there is half an hour old. So it's good. So we know where I am and what I do at that moment.
All right. Laurence, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you.
Helium Talk.